Welcome to This Much I Learned, Marketing Week's regular podcast in which we invite the great and good in marketing and beyond to impart their wisdom and perspective on marketing matters. My name is Russell Parsons, Editor-in-Chief of Marketing Week, and I am your host for this episode. My guest today is Dan Elton, Executive Vice President for Customer at ASOS, where he oversees customer experience and marketing and also sits on the Online Fashion Retailers Executive Committee. Dan is a retail veteran, joining ASOS from Mate.com and following lengthy stints in senior marketing roles at Tesco and Sainsbury's. Just a year into his time at ASOS, he has joined the brand in reset mode. After a bruising period of losses and revenue declines, it is taking steps to boost profitability. Limiting promotional activity to an identified cohort of unprofitable customers and dialing up investment in brand, just a few measures being taken. To talk about the thinking behind some of those moves, the expanding role of marketing, and his career to date, welcome to the podcast, Dan Elton.
Hi, Russell. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's great to be talking to you today. Let me take you back to, I think it was about 2010 when you started at Tesco. What are the biggest changes, do you think, that you've seen in marketing, in retail marketing in particular, for better or worse, in that time?
Great question. I was reflecting on this recently with a member of my team who is kind of on the CMO track themselves. And we were talking about the building blocks of what makes a CMO. And, I think one of the great changes, or one of the encouraging changes that I've seen, is really the kind of democratization of the discipline. I think when I joined Tesco, to be a senior marketing leader, you needed brand management or comms experience. Whereas, and that's obviously incredibly important, but today, we have media experts, we have analysts, we have customer experience experts, we have all kinds of leaders working in the top jobs in marketing. And so, for me, that really is one of the best changes. And I think what comes with that, is not just a benefit from a talent perspective, but also a benefit for the discipline. And I think one of the biggest changes that I've witnessed in retail is that marketing no longer just plays a role, in shaping kind of outward communications with customers, but has an enormous influence over customer experience as well, and actually has a much more realistic understanding about what influences perceptions of a brand and brand favorability. So I think that's probably, my favorite change that I've seen over the years. When I kind of identified this North Star for my own journey that I wanted to be a CMO, I thought, right, well, I've got to get comms experience. And I don't think that's where people need to start today. I think they can start in multiple different places, and that's great. I think you asked for some of the not so good changes, or some of the things that I've observed that maybe aren't so favorable. I think some things that, one thing that's got better and got worse is the way we measure the effectiveness of what we do. There's some people will say I'm crazy for this, but there's no doubt huge benefits to the rise in digital media and the measurability of that. But I think there's an element of laziness in marketing. We see something in Google Ads, or we see something in an attribution model, and we've come to rely on it as the gospel. And that doesn't reflect the real world. That doesn't reflect reality. And I think, too often we make irrational or incorrect decisions as a result of that. And sometimes I wonder, when I'm kind of maybe, having an existential crisis, I wonder whether actually any of it is any better than it was previously, where we used to talk about, half of all marketing being wasted. So I do think, there's obviously elements of measurement that are a lot better, but there is, I think it's some of our muscles have atrophied. The other thing that I think maybe has changed a bit is with the rise of digital media, I see too many people plowing a single furrow. And I see too many young marketers who are happy doing kind of a single discipline and growing up in a single channel. And again, I think that has a detrimental effect for their careers, but it also has a detrimental effect in their development, because it teaches you that channels operate in isolation and that somehow they kind of inherently add value rather than as part of a kind of fruit salad or a cocktail or a mix of creative and media and all kinds of other things. So, I do think that's a bit of an issue as well. And I think in my experience, people were happier moving around and experiencing different things than maybe they are at the moment.
Thank you for kicking us off. There's quite a bit to unpack there. And if you rely on me to, I just want to follow up on a couple of the things that you said there. Let's start at where you finished off, the specialism. And we've done quite a lot of work on this at the moment. And I think one of the main conclusions, because we're finding that there is quite a lot of demand for specialists, data performance in particular. And one of the issues is that they don't necessarily face the world with a strategic understanding, with some of the fundamentals of marketing in place. So being a specialist might mean that you can demand perhaps inflated wages, but it doesn't in any way, shape or form make you a good rounded marketer. Is that something that you've seen?
So I do agree with that premise. I will caveat it by saying I've worked with some brilliant marketers who've come up through a single channel. So it's not a universal experience, but I think your observation there, Russell, is exactly my observation. I think too often, you know, I was always very jealous of my friends who worked for kind of the consumer goods businesses, who had these very broad brand management training and really had a kind of deep theoretical understanding of marketing and marketing frameworks. Whereas I came from a very different route. I came from a kind of strategy consultancy background before I went into marketing. And I think, you know, when that was the predominant training ground for marketers, there was a huge benefit to that. It was also exclusive and it was difficult to get into, and there were, you know, and not always fast moving. And so I think there are downsides to that too. But I think when you are taught that, you know, paid search or paid social or influencer marketing or, you know, data science in some instances is all you need to know, then yeah, it doesn't necessarily give you that overall view of how, you know, marketing works and how consumers build perceptions of brands. So I would say that in the main, I do agree with that.
I mean, yeah, I think it's probably right and proper that, yeah, you have an understanding of brand strategy and also the means to execute, and having this augmenting those skills with the ability and knowledge of how data works, how performance works, it is absolutely going to make you a more rounded marketer. Just picking up on what you were saying about laziness in measurement, again, that resonated with me, and I'm sure it'll resonate with a lot of people who are listening as well. One of the things I've witnessed in my time at Marketing Week, which just about mirrors your time in marketing, is the prevalence often of efficiency over effectiveness. And that often does come down to the way that impact is measured. Attribution has been pointed to in particular as, yes, it might be quite straightforward, relatively speaking, to point to as a measure of success, but it doesn't actually get under the skin of what's sustainable and will drive business outcomes. Dig into attribution and the problem with that a little bit more for me, will you?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say I've read some, you know, really fantastic articles in Marketing Week over the years about this. I remember one particular one, which was, I think, about Adidas and Adidas's approach to effectiveness. And I would say that really touched a nerve with me, and it was something I believed already, and I've kind of subsequently used that and quoted that article a great deal. So I think you folks have written kind of really thoughtfully about this. You know, I think my starting point is that all models are wrong, right? And, you know, one of the failures of marketing organizations over the last five, maybe going back almost 10 years now, is to train our partners to believe that because you can see something in an attribution model, that it must be true or it must be more accurate than, you know, the belief set, the framework, the paradigm you had for that previously. And, you know, in some instance, it is. You know, I've worked in businesses with incredibly sophisticated attributions models that are, you know, a mixture of various different approaches that apply some very sophisticated business rules to it, that, you know, use outstanding incrementality testing to kind of balance off what you're seeing from a kind of click-based perspective. But then I've worked in businesses that rely on a last-click model, and that's it. And no one was questioning it. So I really do think that, you know, the best marketers are able to understand their weaknesses. I think this is true in any role, actually. But, you know, I think it's particularly important for marketers to know what they're wrong about. You know, and there's no doubt that one of the things we're wrong about is what we're measuring. You asked about kind of efficiency and effectiveness. Do you know what, actually? Let me just give you a quick example of that. So when I joined ASOS, we weren't really spending any money with TikTok. Now, we're a brand that is aimed at Gen Z fashion-loving consumers. But we weren't spending any money with TikTok because we didn't have the right measurement set up. And therefore, we're struggling to get budget. The team was struggling to get budget signed off by a finance team who couldn't see it, you know, couldn't see the performance. Now, you can take the view that that's absolutely critical, but you could also take the view, as I did with the leadership team, that our audience is on TikTok. It's the best possible platform to be talking about fashion, or one of the best platforms to be talking about fashion. And in some ways, measurement is much less important than actually being kind of testing, being present, and finding your way in. So I think when you're kind of a hostage to measurement, it's very, very difficult. You asked about efficiency versus effectiveness. I think that's a great question. And I think that the job of marketing teams is to de-risk, you know, both of those things. You know, de-risk your view of efficiency, de-risk your view of effectiveness. Have as many possible ways into that question as you possibly can. You know, I think most of us kind of understand and believe that media returns are an S-curve. And how far over the top of that S-curve are you? And if you are over the top of that S-curve, what do you need to do to de-risk it to get back to an efficient point on your return on investment curve? And, you know, how much risk do you want to take in pushing for that last pound of effectiveness? This is a conversation I have with my team here all the time. You know, they obviously want to maximize profit. And I'm always saying, well, are we really maximizing profit? Because all models are wrong and we're not certain that what we're seeing is the truth, even though we're pretty confident in our measurement approach. So, yeah, I think those two things are deeply connected, and we have to be very cynical about what we're seeing.
Just understanding what you're saying there about all models are wrong, I mean, are we talking here about there's only so much that you can measure? I'm not talking about gut instinct or any of those cliches, but it requires more analysis. It requires forensic investigation. You can line up loads of measures of success, but you have to interpret what's working. No one model will give you everything that you want to hear to give you a pat on the back and say, that's a job well done. Is that what we're talking about here, or have I misinterpreted?
No, I think that's it. I think no matter what kind of approach and framework for measurement you come up with, it's simply not going to reflect reality. Reality is much more complex because every consumer responds differently to media and creative, and you're really just aggregating a view. I think very often the models we use, you know, bias towards a particular channel. And so that doesn't reflect reality because, you know, in the world in which I operate, we're working with a kind of 20-year-old brand. People's incoming assumptions about that brand are a huge part of, you know, influencing how they shop. And that doesn't show up in an attribution model, you know. And so that's what I mean, really, is there's certain things you can measure and there's certain things you can't measure. And even the things that you can measure, you're not going to get a fully accurate view.
Yeah. And how does that play when you are making the case for investment to your exec committee colleagues, your CFO, or whoever it is that you need to make that case to? Because it then becomes a job of telling a story and defining a narrative, doesn't it? As opposed to just being able to point to a spreadsheet and go, here you go.
So I think that's one of the things that I've seen change quite significantly because, you know, I've kind of worked in the marketing space through the era of digitization, really. And I think when I started, you know, and I was kind of relatively junior, I watched the leaders that I worked with really struggle to make a kind of hard quantitative case for investment. But they tried to. And now I think we have all the tools available to make that hard quantitative case, but we're too confident in it. And so, you know, one of the things that I always try to do is just be very honest about where the weaknesses are in our approach and provide an upside view and a downside view. And that's kind of what I mean by de-risking your interpretation. I think when you do that, you often have a much better relationship with finance colleagues and, you know, particularly the CFO because, you know, CFOs don't operate in a binary world. They don't want a marketing director or a CMO who's going to say to them, give me this and I can deliver this, because they know that just isn't the case. That's what I mean by that.
Let me fast forward to ASOS and your job there, which actually has echoes in terms of some of the challenges of some of the things that we've already talked about. I mean, to some, ASOS has become a bit of a cautionary tale of late, indicative of the risk investing or over-investing in promotions and performance and the corrosive impact that that can have on profitability. What was your assessment when you came in of what the big challenges were? And talk to us about some of the things that you've done to address some of those challenges, particularly in the area of promotion and performance.
I would challenge the assessment of a cautionary tale, but I understand what you're saying.
I will caveat by saying that's as much my words, my take on it. I'm more than happy for you to counter. You're the one in the room.
Let me kind of give you my view or kind of our view as I understand it. So, you know, I think ASOS, you know, is a business that did extremely well during obviously the very difficult time that was the COVID pandemic. When stores were closed, ASOS was kind of there for consumers and we grew very rapidly. And in large part, the reliance on promotions has been as a result of, you know, expectations of that growth continuing coming out of the pandemic and having a bit too much stock. And so it's really a necessity rather than a direction of the brand. You know, we need to clear that stock, and so we've been promoting to do so. But it's not the direction that we want to take the business in the future. And actually this year, we're reducing those promotions quite significantly, and we have a journey to take consumers on. I think, you know, one of the things I will say, and I've said kind of publicly before, is that when I joined ASOS, 85% of all media investment there or thereabouts was spent at the very bottom of the funnel. You know, in Google search, in kind of meta DPA ads, if you're that way inclined and you understand that. And very little was spent outside of that. And again, that was appropriate at a time when, you know, all we had to do was show up at the last stage of the purchase journey to kind of win the conversion, because it was a bit less competitive, there was a lot more demand. But that isn't true anymore. So one of my first assessments was, you know, well, we really need to put ASOS back in the conversation. We were hearing from consumers that they loved the ASOS brand, but compared to our competitors, they just didn't hear from us anymore. They didn't hear from us in the cultural conversation. They didn't hear from us in kind of modern media environments. Like I talked about TikTok before, we didn't really have an influencer program until I joined. And so one of the first things that we had to do was really rebuild that muscle and start putting ASOS, like I say, back at the forefront of customers' minds. I think if you're a Byron Sharp fan, what we're talking about here is rebuilding mental availability. We're not talking about rocket science. We're talking about finding ways to rebuild mental availability for fashion consumers. So I think that's the biggest thing. You know, one of the other things we're trying to do is really laser in on those experiences that drive customer value. And we're very fortunate to be a e-commerce retailer with massive amounts of first-party data. And so we know what drives customer value. We know what consumers love about our brand and what they don't, the experiences that will grow lifetime value and those that will be detrimental. And so what we're really trying to do is kind of make it easier for customers to, you know, take those experiences, take those leaps, maybe incentivize them where we need to, using maybe a more targeted approach to promotion to grow lifetime value, rather than doing kind of wholesale promotions to clear through stock. And then I think the third thing that we're doing is connecting the brand ambition with the customer experience. And I think, I'm putting ASOS in this bucket, but actually it's my belief that in general, e-commerce retailers have become, you know, somewhat commoditized from an experience perspective. You know, there are some super interesting retail experiences in e-commerce, but there's not loads. And so the third thing that we're doing is really trying to make the customer experience much more exciting, much more engaging, to win outside of the purchase cycle, not just focus on conversion. You know, I think too many retailers, too many e-commerce businesses focus on conversion excellence at the detriment of making their experience exciting and thrilling and engaging. And so we're working on that as well. So those were the kind of the three things that we're focused on in the marketing team.
Let me take each one of those in turn, if I could. Just the your honest assessment of where you were in regards to an investment at the bottom of the funnel. You have introduced a new brand platform since you've come in, and Marketing Week has written about that. Is your ambition to get closer to the 60-40 optimum that Nir Field talk about, brand and performance? Do you subscribe to that? Is that a North Star for you?
I and the marketing leadership team at ASOS are big believers in that theory, in Nir Field. So absolutely. I can't say we spend our days measuring how close we're getting to 60-40, which I know that's not what you meant, but we definitely believe that we need to find a better balance between, you know, activity that drives long-term goals and activity that drives short-term goals. So yes, I would say the simple answer to that is yes, we are. I think it's not always so simple, because actually we live in an environment in the moment, particularly in fashion, where we're having to hand over quite a lot of, you know, ownership and agency of brand communications to third parties, by which I mean influencers. You know, people make decisions about fashion purchases, not really based on what the fashion brand says themselves. And it's a bit different for Lux, to be honest, in the luxury space. But in the environment in we operate, it's very significantly driven by creators, fashion lovers, fashion influencers. Do those drive long-term effects, or do those drive short-term effects? It's not always clear. Sometimes it's both. And so actually the way we treat those things is something that we're finding our way through at the moment. You know, when we were a largely paid search advertiser, it was very obvious that that was driving a short-term effect, a much less significant long-term effect. In terms of how we change our media mix at the moment, it's a bit more complicated.
I suppose in the scheme of things, influencers, or use of influencers, is relatively new. I suppose, well, unless you count brand ambassador and advocates of old, of course. But actually working out what levers they're pulling or what effect that they're having is still difficult to navigate your way through by the sales of things anyway.
I think we've got some brilliant partners. So many of your listeners will be familiar with Tribe Dynamics and Connor Begley, who founded that business or co-founded that business. And, you know, I think Connor has a fantastic paradigm for how to measure the effectiveness of work in social media, work of influencers. And there are others. I know there are others, you know, Ben Jeffries and the influencer team do a great job too. So, you know, there are ways to do it. We're a big subscriber in the idea that actually what we're trying to do is grow earned media value. But it's a new discipline for the business. And we don't have this evidence base for what it will deliver. So, you know, at the moment, we're slightly testing our way.
Talking about promotions as you were, actually, let me ask the question, a slightly different question. I'm fascinated by if you, and there, I think it was identified by your own CEO, I mentioned it in my introduction, that there is a percentage of your customers who are very used to receiving offers. I would extend that with the expectation of free returns. I appreciate that the majority of returns will remain free, but I think there are moves. It becomes a behavioral change challenge, doesn't it? Is to change expectation and manage people through that expectation and not lose them as a customer, so they feel that they're getting the experience that you spoke of, that you're looking to improve, and the value, but not necessarily expecting that they're going to be paying discounted prices and return everything for free. So how are you going about trying to enact that behavior change?
It is, I would say that's the toughest question that I feel we're facing, or that I'm facing on the customer side of the organization. I think, you know, where you have a business model that customers love, but which in not every case leads to a profitable outcome for the business, how do you navigate your way through that? So I think there are some ways are easier than others, right? You know, we are trying to build a fashion-focused business that relies on full-price sales rather than promotional sales. And we're doing, I would say, a good job of that. You know, we've talked in the past about shortening our lead times, buying smaller quantities so that we don't necessarily have to commit to product in quite the same way as we have done historically. And that will enable us to do less promotions, and it will enable us to develop more relevant products because we're developing it closer to the point of purchase as well. So, you know, and we're seeing really strong results from some of that. So I think probably the best way you can do it is through the product that you're delivering. The challenge that you mentioned is, you know, how do you, a lot of the customers who do take advantage of or do make use of or get value from some of those aspects of your customer experience are actually in many ways your most engaged. You know, they will shop with us 10, 15 times a year. They might return quite a high proportion of their products. They might shop on promotion. Now, we don't want to lose those customers. They're incredibly valuable customers to ASOS, but we need to find a way to kind of decrease that loss-making activity. And that's part of the customer experience challenge. So, you know, do you find a way to increase ads to basket? Do you find a way to make the size and fit clearer on the website so that actually customers aren't returning maybe quite so much? There's lots of different things that we can do and that we are doing, but they're all aimed really at what you said, Russell, which is trying to make unprofitable customers profitable.
Yeah, I mean, it's about differentiation. I imagine experience is part of that attempt at differentiation. Experience, customer experience was a word that, or a phrase that I don't think I heard when I first joined Marketing Week. Another one of those kind of 10 to 15 year emerging trends, for want of a better way of putting it. Talk to me a little bit more about what you're going to do from the point of view of improving the customer experience. What does that mean for you? And I'll ask a supplementary question if I could, calling back to what you said at the beginning about the emergence of people doing your role, people who oversee customer and brand and all touch points in between. I mean, what's the value of that as well?
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm actually going to start there if that's okay. And I'm going to tell you a little anecdote, if I may, which I think brings it to life. So in my last role at Tesco, I was the customer insight director. And, you know, I don't think I realized it at the time. That was my first kind of role working with the customer insight team. But we had an absolutely fantastic team there, really, truly excellent team. And I inherited that from my predecessor. It had absolutely nothing to do with me. And we did every year. Tesco was quite famous for doing this piece of work called the brand review, which wasn't just a brand review, it was kind of a business review. It was a strategic business review. And we did this massive piece of research, which was all about what drives NPS and what drives brand effects. We were moving the business to measuring NPS, and we wanted to demonstrate really to all of our retail colleagues what they could do. And what that showed is what a lot of your listeners and you are definitely going to know is that, you know, when you rank the drivers of kind of brand impact, communications for most industries, and certainly for food, grocery, retail, is kind of quite close to the bottom. Communications are relatively unimportant. What is most important, you know, is experience and then product. And product is obviously the most, I think most of us would have expected that, but experience comes very close to the top. So I thought to myself, well, here I am trying to build a career in this profession in an industry in which communications actually doesn't play a particularly significant role. And then we did a piece of econometric modeling in another part of the team that showed that in grocery, communications actually has a very limited effect on your driver of store choice compared to, you know, say fashion or general merchandise, where, you know, products are maybe a bit more commoditized and consumers can make different choices. So that was the point in my career where I decided if I'm going to stay in marketing, I want to work in broader customer roles. And I think a lot of other people have come to the same realization, which is marketers are at their best when they're applying the same consumer insight that they're using to build, you know, brand plans or communications plans and apply it to customer experience. So, you know, I think there's enormous benefit in that, and a lot of organizations at the moment. In terms of, you asked me what we're doing and our focus, and I think really it's, I'll give you a relatively simple answer to that, if that's okay. We're trying to do two things. The first thing we're trying to do is really laser in on customer failures, the paper cuts that prevent customers from coming back. And, you know, our churn has been too high. Our customer churn has been too high. Some of it is churn that's caused naturally by the kind of washout of e-commerce, the e-commerce wave that happened during COVID. But some of it is unwanted, and some of it's caused by customer failures that might be invisible to the people who sit in head office, but is probably visible to our contact center teams, to our warehouse teams, et cetera, et cetera. So we're doing a piece of work at the moment to really understand that and make sure our resources are aligned to kind of removing those paper cuts, removing those customer failures. That's not big, it's not sexy, but it's a very, very important piece of work. And it's particularly critical in retail. The other thing we're doing then is really connecting what has always been a marketing strategy with a kind of the digital product team, making sure that we're working on the same brand goals, you know, and we really want to position ASOS at kind of the intersection of fashion and entertainment in some ways. I talked before about winning outside the moment of purchase. So what we're trying to do is develop experiences, products on site, develop marketing content, develop social content that thrills customers and keeps them engaged, doesn't necessarily try to sell to them, doesn't mean they're going to necessarily buy an additional product in that moment, but will keep them much more engaged in the customer experience. And I think for me, you don't have to look too far in other categories to see businesses and brands that do that really well. So I think there's some examples for us to build off that.
Yeah. What does good look like then? Who are you looking to for inspiration?
Yeah, I mean, I think you look at the platforms like TikTok, you look at Netflix, they do a phenomenal job of keeping people engaged. You know, the social media, all the social media platforms do a great job of that. And I think, you know, that's the interesting thing for us is we have a number of competitors from a product and fashion perspective. We have other competitors from a media perspective. And then we have other competitors still from an attention perspective. And so trying to kind of triangulate those things and work out who you're competing against in each of those spaces is very important.
No shortage of challenges. If you were to identify one thing that's, let's start with the negative. What the one thing that's keeping you awake at night, you're trying to nail, but you feel that you are short of at the moment, what would that be, Dad?
You talked about a reset at the start. You know, we're in a bit of a transformation journey in marketing at the moment for the brand overall in some ways. And, you know, we're at the point in the journey where we've developed a plan. We're delivering on that plan, but you're not at the end of the journey yet. And so, you know, in some ways, what keeps me up at night is the plan the right plan and are we delivering? And there's obviously lots of green shoots, but, you know, I think any self-respecting leader questions themselves all the time, maybe not as much as I do. But there's you know, the general thing that's keeping me up at night. I think what's particularly keeping me up at night at the moment is, you know, our efficiencies, where we are on our response curves. The market is very dynamic. I'm sure a lot of your listeners who work in the media space are experiencing significantly rising input costs. You know, we see unit costs increasing in media very significantly. And so that's keeping me, you know, that's keeping our kind of media team on their toes. I would say that's keeping me awake.
And what's the thing that's getting you skipping out of bed in the morning?
Again, it's kind of the other side of that same thing, which is we're on this transformation journey in the marketing team at ASOS. So we've got all of this super exciting activity going on, particularly around in real life marketing, working with creators and influencers, working on sponsorships, working in upper funnel media that the team haven't done, you know, many of the team haven't done at ASOS and ASOS hasn't done for a very long time. So there's huge opportunity and it's incredibly exciting there. And we're really building those teams and that's great. So that, you know, again, in general terms, that's what's getting me kind of most excited or keeping me most excited.
You're relatively young in your career, but you've got plenty of experience behind you to perhaps answer this next question. I just wondered if there was a moment in your career that you regret, that you would identify as failure. What would that be? And what did you learn from it?
I've been through some very difficult moments. I would say I'm a relentless optimist. And so eventually, I always reframe failure as something else. And so sitting here today, I don't really look at those times as failure, but there are some obvious, they felt like it at the time. So I'll give you an example. So, you know, I in April 2022, I joined MADE as the Chief Customer Officer. And I was coming out of Google, which was a fantastic job. I'd absolutely loved it. You know, myself and the team had a lot of success in the 3 years that I'd been there. This was my first exec role. It's something I'd always wanted. And when I'd agreed to join, the business was growing very rapidly. It was clear pretty quickly that something was wrong. And, you know, 6 months later, the business went into administration, sadly. And at the time, that felt like an enormous personal failure. And it felt like a personal failure from a career perspective. And it felt like a personal failure from in terms of, you know, I couldn't save the business. You know, I think a lot of leaders take personal responsibility, as I certainly do. And I felt like, well, you know, I couldn't save the business. Now, over time, in the 2 years since then, I've kind of reframed that. You know, that was the most incredible learning experience. I learned more in those 6 months than I did probably in the previous 5 years. And, you know, particularly about leading through difficult times. You know, Nicola Thompson was the CEO. She's remarkable. And, you know, what I learned an enormous amount from her about leadership in a crisis. I learned more about my own resilience as well. So, you know, to give you a straight answer, it feels like that was probably the most significant failure in my career, Russell. But I have reframed it mentally.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose macro circumstances and local challenges to the company itself were the primary reasons for Made.com's failure. But I can imagine it's a knock to confidence when you've invested a lot of time and energy in making that move. Because from Google, a hugely successful global corporation, and as you say, you can point to significant success in the time that you were there, and then to go to a company that was, well, revealed itself to be struggling and in a fundamental and serious way. I can imagine that was something that was going to knock confidence, but at the same time, you learn from what doesn't work and didn't work as much as perhaps even more than you do from what does as well. Just final question for you, Dan, if I could. If there was one piece of advice, perhaps that somebody's passed on to you or that you've learned that you'd like to pass on to others, what would that be? A single thing, true to the name of this podcast, This Much I Learn. If you were to pass that on, what would it be?
Okay, I'll give you one. And then if you've got time, I'll give you another, because I've kind of got two that I generally pass on to the people I work with. I think the first one may be something that your listener has heard before, which is, you know, if someone gives you an opportunity to do something that seems very challenging and you don't know how to do it, you don't feel that you have the skills, but it's something that, you know, deep down excites you, even if there's an element of kind of nervousness there, just say yes to that opportunity and work out how to do it later. You know, I think one of the things I've learned is that the world presents very few opportunities and you don't owe anyone anything. And putting yourself in a box, self-limiting, being scared of failure is just going to hold you back. So back yourself, give yourself a chance. You may not get it right first time, but in general, the universe will reward you for taking that step. So be ambitious for yourself, I think. Yeah, well, I do. I mean, I guess the other one is a bit more obvious, really. But I think if you aspire for vertical growth, you know, and not everyone does, but, you know, if you aspire for kind of vertical growth in terms of going up an organization, I think the thing that I've seen is have a North Star and then work out what the building blocks for that are and go and get those building blocks, make them happen. And not all the building blocks will be roles that you are particularly interested in or want to do. You know, at an earlier stage of my career, I did some roles that I really wasn't that interested in, but they did seem like building blocks to being a CMO, and they very much were, and it served me well in the kind of medium term. And again, you'll be rewarded for that. But I think unless you're deliberate about your career planning, you know, you're putting your faith in others to make things happen for you. So that's the second piece of advice I'd give.
Have a North Star, but say yes to everything in pursuit of getting there. I'll combine the two things together. Dan, fantastic to talking to you today. Thank you very much for such sage advice and for walking us through both your career to date or aspects of it, and also your job and the challenges that you face at ASOS. Until next time, goodbye. You have been listening to This Much I Learn with me, Russell Parsons, produced by Georgie Chantrell Plan and edited by Mihai Andre. You can listen to previous episodes of This Much I Learn on Apple or Spotify podcasts or wherever you get them. Until next time, goodbye.